Esther 5. In verse 12. Haman said, moreover, yea, Esther the queen did let no man come in with the king unto the banquet that she had prepared but myself. And tomorrow am I invited unto her also with the king. Yet all this availeth me nothing, so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. Then said Zeresh's wife and all his friends unto him, let a gallows be made of 50 cubits high, and tomorrow speak thou unto the king that Mordecai may be hanged thereon. Then go thou in merrily with the king unto the banquet. And the thing pleased Haman, and he caused the gallows to be made. We know Haman has reached the pinnacle of his power, the high point of his life. It's not going to get any better for Haman. For a brief moment, Haman, as he's exiting this private feast, he experiences a sense of contentment unlike anything he's known. He's just had an audience, a private audience with the king and queen, and there is nothing that will ever again compare with that sense of elation, that sense of contentment, the sense of pride and self-worth that Haman now had. For just a moment, there's nothing that could add to his own sense of accomplishment, to his own sense of well-being, than being present for that wine feast made by the queen ostensibly for him. Now I say ostensibly because if we have an eye to the text, we should actually perceive Esther has not made this feast for him so much as she's made this feast against him. Indeed, there is, if we have eyes to see, a trap being laid at his feet. Remember Solomon's warning in Proverbs 29:5, a man that flattereth his neighbor spreadeth a net for his feet. Now, the more pride, the more inflated the sense of self-worth a person has, the easier it is to flatter them into spreading this net. And Haman, throughout the whole of the Bible, Haman is someone who is characterized by pride or vanity more than anyone. So this feast made for Haman is not really for his honor. Rather, it's to unveil his shame, his great swelling pride. I want you to consider for a moment the shame of Haman's pride, or Haman's vanity, as a lot of the Puritans would call it. It appears in several things. And it does several things. First of all, Haman's pride, or Haman's vanity, increases his demerit. That is, his worthiness to be censured. It was his pride that caused Haman to seek to punish not merely Mordecai, but the whole Jewish nation for the lack of reverence shown to him by Mordecai. And at no time would his pride or vanity allow him to see that he was a proponent of a false religion, who had been elevated to a position of power by an immoral power and was therefore unworthy of such reverencing. Now this alone is worthy of demerit, but when you add persecution of the righteous to an overweening sense of self-importance, it is much more so. the shame of Haman's pride or vanity appears, secondly, in that it feeds his delusion. It increases his demerit, but it feeds his delusion. Haman's vanity or pride has placed blinders on his eyes so that he thinks himself not only worthy of all of the honors that he feels have accrued to him, but he thinks himself worthy of the honors Mordecai has denied him by failing to reverence him. His delusion is that he really believes that it belonged to him, this privilege of a private feast, a wine banquet with the king and queen, that somehow that belonged to him. He perceives in himself to have achieved what he deserves. He's one of those kinds of people. And the higher he climbs the ladder of Persian success, the more he's assuring himself that he really does deserve all that he's getting out of life. His pride is increasing his demerit. It's feeding his delusion. But third, it's hiding his danger. The pride of Haman doesn't allow him to see the danger that's rising toward him and his family. For now, he sees everything through his own deluded vanity. And that's preaching peace and safety to him. He's a prophet of his own doom, isn't he? He's saying peace and safety when sudden destruction is on the horizon. Now with the feast, Haman, through a complete lack of discernment, Haman has actually come to believe that he's closer than ever to achieving total contentment, when in fact he's about to be punished for his wickedness. Now this should teach us something about the nature of fallen men. Prosperity apart from obedience to God should never be viewed as a blessing. It's really just a fattening of the cattle for the slaughter. And yet how many people think that their prosperity, their success in life, is some indication that God or providence or fate or chance, some force beyond their control smiles upon them and somehow they're being blessed. Prideful men rejoice to achieve success in this world when they don't have sure hope of finding salvation in the next. They should remember what Jesus said, or what Jesus asked when he said, "What does it profit a man to gain the whole world and lose his own soul?" Haman isn't doing that. His delusion is hiding the danger. But fourth, it's also going to ensure his destruction. Haman's pride or his vanity, finally, because it doesn't allow him to see the danger, it also doesn't allow him to avoid the danger and its consequences. And it will turn out that what Haman sees as so many points of elevation, so many points of achievement, are really a series of steps climbing to the top of the gallows upon which he himself shall be hanged. Now, Haman's joyfulness, his glad heart, are, as I've mentioned before, functions of Haman's pride, his vanity. And that's why the rabbis saw this as the only moment in Haman's life when he knew happiness. Because prior to this, His pride was driving him to press on to higher and higher heights of success. And shortly after this, all of his vanity or pride is going to be deflated when he stumbles across Mordecai sitting at the king's gate refusing to reverence him again. Now again, is this the blessing of God on Haman that he brought him to such heights? I think not. No, I think in this we see the justice and the judgment of God, who raises Haman to such a point that he would know somewhat of that which he is going to be deprived, happiness and contentment. His elevation then only serves to make his punishment much more harsh. You know, if you're one of those people who's never known happiness or contentment, if you've never known achievement or success, well, being deprived of those things is nothing to you. You have no comparison. And again, we have to remember that all that men acquire apart from God is actually illicit and ill-gotten gains, of which they shall soon be deprived. So for the wicked, memories of the comforts and preferments of this life will only serve to deepen their eternal torments. That's something Jesus alludes to when he speaks of Lazarus and the rich man in the afterlife. Luke 16:25, Abraham said, "Son," he's talking to the rich man now, "remember that thou in thy lifetime receivest thy good things, and likewise Lazarus' evil things. But now he is comforted, and thou art tormented." In and of themselves, they are good things. But in connection with the wicked, they become points, so many points, that will in fact be points of torment to all eternity. Now we're given a glimpse of Haman's pride or vanity in the assembly, and perhaps it was a feast, which he has called upon returning to his own home that evening after the private banquet with the king and the queen. And in the midst of the comfort of friends and family, we see that Haman recounts his many perceived blessings. He's speaking of the glory of his riches. I want you to note that, by the way. Not only the riches, but what the text says, he speaks of the glory or the honor that having these things implies belongs to him. You know, by reason of possessing these riches, that means there must be some honor or glory that pertains to him. Now, in making that assessment from the very beginning as he's listing things, we see he's making what I would call a category mistake common to unbelievers. And that is, he sees his possessions as somehow augmenting or increasing the value of his own person. I'm not saying all unbelievers do this, but it's a very common thing amongst unbelievers. It's a very common thing amongst professing Christians. But I guess we could question whether or not they're more than just professing Christians if they're caught up in this kind of delusion. And next to this, he adds the multitude of his children. And it's true, the Bible does tell us that children are the heritage of the Lord. Children are one of the chief blessings which God bestows upon men in this life. However, here again, he's mistaken. This blessing is not absolute. Children aren't always a blessing, are they? Sometimes they are when they prove to be faithful and honorable. You know, a wise son maketh a glad father. But then there are those other children that prove to be more of a curse and a burden. The foolish man despiseth his mother, Proverbs 15:20. So we see foolish children, so far from being a blessing, they're a grief to be born and a burden upon the earth. And Haman's children are only truly a blessing when and if they embrace their station in submission to the true religion. It's very difficult for children to be a true blessing apart from the influences and effects of true religion. What kind of blessing could Haman discover in children whose very lives will burden the earth with their wickedness? Because no matter how civilly upright they are, the fact that they're not going to live their lives to the glory of God is burdensome. Now, as Haman continues to boast of his prosperity, he turns to the rise and prestige that he'd received at the hand of the king. And in this, his vanity, his pride, perceived royal comment on his self-worth, right? He thought the king was making some statement about the value of his person. In reality, the great political machine that is tyrannical, he's going to find out that he's actually very replaceable. You know, it's a very common thing. People think so highly of themselves, they think they're irreplaceable. They think because they've been elevated to some position that they can't be done without. You know, the world will stop everything, will come to a halt if they're removed from that position. It's just not true. Especially not true in the Persian Empire. Because here the rise in position and prestige is solely dependent upon the whim of the king. But since Haman is going to pin his sense of self-worth on a king's volatile mood, he's going to find himself sorely disappointed in due time. Because as Moses says elsewhere of another enemy of the people of God, in due time his foot shall slide. Finally, Haman had recounted that consolidation of power that he'd received being placed over the various governors, the various officials, all of the Persian nobility and governing offices throughout the kingdom. All the princes and all the servants of the king, he alludes to this in previous verses, they were there and they were going to do his bidding. And in fact, he was sure of this, he could boast of this, that they were even now doing his bidding. Why? Because they're carrying his decree to destroy the Jews from Shushan to the farthest reaches of the empire, and they're publishing it, making it known, and they're getting it ready. And yet these princes and servants, as we actually can note from his own words, belong to the king and not to Haman. And that, again, is going to be a problem for him. If you're going to sink all your hope in this world, you should at least be careful to make sure it doesn't hang upon something so slender and uncertain as the goodwill of a king who is known to be volatile. Nevertheless, Haman is actually feeling at this point especially confident in his standing after this banquet. And moreover, the prospect of another banquet, again in his honor, together with the king, that seems to him to portend even greater heights of worldly prosperity, doesn't it? So thus, he continues to make out his case to his friends and family in verse 12. Haman said, moreover, yea, Esther the queen did let no man come in with the king unto the banquet that she prepared, but myself. And tomorrow am I invited unto her also with the king. Haman says, moreover, yea. Haman doesn't rest then upon his general assent to be seated next to the throne. He could have stopped the story there, but he continues. He's concerned to add to the tale that he's telling to his friends and his family the most recent developments, which again seem to him in his pride to portend well. Now in the Hebrew, and it's reflected in the English translation, what follows is set off a bit in the text from the previous things which he'd mentioned when he was recounting his various blessings, at least things he probably viewed as indications that fate or fortune smiled upon his undertakings in this life. Yea, or also, that little interjection there indicates that just when it seemed in his telling and probably in his thinking about and reflecting on this whole matter, just when it seemed to Haman as if he had arrived at the highest point of success, another unexpected but impressive thing had occurred. Right? When he's listed these other things in the previous verses, even to his thinking, he had probably topped it out. But now, perhaps in the mind of Haman, this most recent turn of events was actually going to represent that plateauing and crowning of his achievements. And at the same time, he must have known that this was something he hadn't sought out. And that probably makes it even more interesting to him. The very fact that it was so unanticipated, most likely it made it seem to him to be the clearest sign that fortune was shining down on him. Now, like a lot of the other things that we talked about, or that he talked about in listing his blessings, he could, to a certain extent, say, you know, I did this or I did that. You know, I pressed for this, right? I worked hard to get those riches. I married, I had a wife, I produced those children. I did this or that to gain the attention of the king and gain his confidence. And I rose in his estimation through all of these things. But this one, remember, he was just sitting at home when he gets the invitation to come to this banquet. So he has to be thinking, wow, he must have done something very right when he cast Pur, that lot, to determine the precise time to dispatch those troublesome Jews. Because everything now is falling out in his favor. Everything seems to be going above and beyond what he could have anticipated. The winds are all blowing in his direction. So much so that now Haman stood before his friends and family as one, from his perspective, who's come into the great blessings which demonstrate not only that he is on the side of fate or fortune, but that fate or fortune is on his side. At this point, he's got to be thinking, maybe he didn't occupy the Persian throne directly, but his place in the destiny of all things appeared to be confirmed by what he's relating to them now. It's true, the king had summoned him to a banquet, and he had just now returned from it. He'd been to a feast which the king and queen had presented to him, and that's not all. He points out next, he says, Esther the queen did let no man come in with the king. So as he's now beginning to relate or recount this latest event, I think it's significant that he mentions Esther did let no man come in. Now, there's several things here. Right, by this, he's acknowledging that he realizes she is the moving force behind the events at hand. Now, in this, if he wasn't so prideful, if his vanity wasn't so swelling within him, having been around the throne for a little while, he should have detected a shift in power and policy. But as noted, his vanity or his pride would not and could not let him consider any such thing. And when he calls her Esther, he refers to her here as Esther. He's intimating to his friends and family that he is on a certain level, that he has a certain familiarity with her, which he immediately balances, by the way, by calling her the queen. By calling her Esther, he's indicating to them that he fancies her somewhat to be a peer with himself. And so I think by mentioning that she's the queen, what he's really trying to do is deepen the impressiveness of the meeting. What he's doing is it's not so much that he's trying to bring her down to his level as he's trying to put himself up to her level in his own mind and in the mind of his friends and family. He's not at the banquet with just any Esther in the kingdom, right? He's with the Esther who is also the queen herself. So his language here is, I think, carefully designed to cast an impression, while at the same time, it betrays that uneasy fact of the queen's influence in the present matter under our consideration. And yet, he can't see that. Esther the queen did let no man come in with the king under the banquet that she had prepared. He acknowledges that she not only was she the gatekeeper, but she's the author of the banquet. So she's determining who could come to it, but she also was the one who had made the determination to have it. And the king is enforcing Esther's desires. Again, this should have caused Haman to think more upon what was happening. But his pride got in the way. Haman knows that Esther had made this banquet and that she had done so with him in mind. He knows that. But whatever caution he might have felt initially, that is, the rabbis have indicated he knew something of her relation to Mordecai. So he might have had some cautious sense initially, especially as soon as he knew the banquet was solely her idea. But now, the way he's telling the story indicates that all concern that he might have had, if he had any, had vanished away. And that Esther's part has actually become a greater reason for him to glory in the favor he believes has fallen upon him. Now, this should have been a big warning signal, and instead he reads it as just another evidence of glorious fate or fortune smiling upon his undertaking. That's not good. We know that Esther had made this banquet after several days of fasting and prayer. And we know that she's executing some kind of plan that, as it unfolds, gives us every reason to believe it was conceived in prayer and favored by providence. And we know that her plan that is unfolding will serve the interests of the deliverance of the church and people of God. And Haman just smiles like a pig at the trough being fattened for the slaughter. Esther the queen did let no man come in with the king unto the banquet that she had prepared but myself. See, when Esther prepared this banquet for me, he says, she kept everyone from it except the king and me. From this, he concludes that she was bestowing upon him special favor. Again, I would say that we should see everything Haman thinks, everything that Haman says, is being run through this filter of his own pride. Once more, a fact that should have raised a number of alarms fails to attract Haman's attention. Nonetheless, as I indicated last time, the literary parallel here of the calling of Haman with the calling of Vashti earlier in the book bodes very ill for him. Even if you hadn't read the rest of the book, hopefully you have, and you know where this is going, but if you haven't, you should still have an uneasy sense where this is all going. There is implied in this a certain perverseness that he found such pleasure in being the only one invited. And think about it. Normally a banquet or a feast is pleasurable because of the guests who've been invited, because of the meal that's been provided, because of the social occasion. Haman's pride is not only an inflated sense of self-worth, it carries with it a distorted view of all things, wherein the only thing of importance to Haman is Haman himself. So he could go to a banquet, and in his mind, he had a great time, because, frankly, from his point of view, he was the only one there. Oh, and the king. And the queen. But again, from his point of view, that's not lowering them. That's elevating himself. In fact, if she had had other people there, it would have been harder for him to think that way. So by doing this, she's actually feeding his pride. And that is exactly what will make him slip up and make those mistakes that will lead to his demise. Esther the queen did let no man come in with the king unto the banquet that she had prepared but myself, and tomorrow am I invited unto her. Here again, we see the confidence that Haman has in his present standing. And as I've noted, his joyfulness, his happiness, his pleasure, all of this has reached its pinnacle because he'd left one private banquet in anticipation of another, both of which were being held for him. Part of what made his joyfulness as complete and full as it was the expectation of future reward. I want you to think about that, no matter how fulfilling that banquet might have been on its own, it would not have carried him quite to the height of exultation, joyfulness, gladness of heart, if it had been lacking a promise of future bliss. And he might have been thinking, this is all going to be over soon. But once this other banquet is held out before him, it carries him even a little bit higher. So specifically, he mentions that Esther has invited him unto her. Again, that language that's used in the Hebrew, and it's actually quite clear, she's invited him unto her. From our point of view, knowing what we know, that sounds like someone who's being invited into a trap. But from Haman's point of view, this sounds like greater and greater degrees of glory and honor being bestowed upon him. Now, although the English says Haman is invited, and the Hebrew is passive, and so I think it genuinely admits of that, it should be, I think we should remember here that turning down the invitation of the queen was probably not a realistic option. Just remember again what had happened earlier when Vashti turned down the king. It didn't turn out so well. And this, too, probably wouldn't have gone so well. It's really not probably an option. Additionally, the notion that he'd been invited to or for her, I think, is also perhaps a veiled reminder that she is now exercising power over Haman, and that signals the end of his reign, even though he hasn't gotten the message yet. Tomorrow am I invited unto her also with the king. Now, again, we see here part of the event that's feeding Haman's pride is the knowledge of that coming banquet, like the previous one, consisted of him and the king. He doesn't know of any others being invited. In fact, at this point, he probably isn't anticipating. And so from this, he undoubtedly feels confident, because after all, it meant the queen was placing him upon the same footing as the king for the purpose of these banquets. Now, he doesn't really know what the purpose of these banquets are yet, the purpose is yet. Of course, that is true, that she's placing him on the same footing right now with the king. But that's not something in which Haman would put much confidence if he only knew Esther's relation to the Jews. I mean, if he really understood what was going on. Moreover, if he did know that she had some favor toward Mordecai, and if he was hesitant when he was called the first time, he now seems, to his own way of thinking, certain any danger's past, and anything that awaits him is just more glory and an increased status in the Persian society. Whereas I think any right-thinking person might have been alarmed at how the king, perhaps, would perceive the queen bestowing such attention on someone other than himself. But you see, Haman is so full of pride, he's so vain, that he apparently thought himself deserving, and it, to him, is an obvious choice, right? If I'm going to have a party with the king, who else would I invite? Well, no one else but Haman. So he's oblivious to the possibility this continued invitation might be misconstrued. And in fact, we're going to see that there are some misconstruals that arise, and in all likelihood, they're rooted in the fact that Haman is so willing to go to this banquet as the only person other than the king. It might have been excused the first time around, because he couldn't have known that. But this time, he knows. And so when he shows up, that is probably going to be a good reason for the king to start asking himself questions. And that will lead directly to the king misconstruing a series of events in subsequent chapters that lead to Haman's demise. So verse 13. Yet all this availeth me nothing, so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. He says all of this. He's talking about everything he's just listed, up to and including attendance of this banquet and invitation to the next banquet. So though he was brimming with pride and swollen with a sense of self-worth as he walks out of that first banquet, as Haman is relating this to his friends and family, it's clear he's no longer content. His joyfulness peaked as he left the first banquet in anticipation of the next. It's then that he comes to realize that true happiness and contentment is not in all those things he just listed. Why do I say that? His wealth, his children, his promotion, his power, even his great privilege. As he relates all of this, he has to understand within himself all of these things couldn't really bring him contentment. Because he realizes there's something still that he doesn't yet have. And it's notable that Haman actually at this moment dismisses the totality of his possessions. Everything he's just rehearsed for his friends and family, he dismisses him as nothing. Now the Hebrew expresses this as a comparison. So Haman is asserting, in other words, there's something which, when he thinks about it, reduces all that he has just recounted, all that list, it's reduced it to be as like nothing to him. In that, whether Haman sees it or not, we can see that Haman's pride or vanity is grounded less in his possessions than he or we might originally have thought. Rather, it's grounded in the relation of those possessions to himself. Not just that he possesses them, but he possesses them in such a way that they bestow upon him some honor. Because Haman's concern is for honor. And each of those things he listed were valued, and that list proceeds in proportion to their ability to bestow upon him honor. Thus, as he's marching through the list, each thing mentioned represents a higher degree of honor that they are able to bestow. Now, I want to suggest to you that honor is a very strange thing. It carries with it a pleasure that is psychological and immaterial, rather than physical or material. As long as I have honor, I'm able to maintain the psychological pleasure of regarding myself as an important person. Haman's great idol is not all of his possessions. His great idol is actually himself. Now that illusion of being an important person is easy to maintain, but if one person doesn't give me that honor, which I believe I deserve, it's going to strike at my psychological pleasure. It's going to attack my perception. It's going to destroy my ability to perceive the honor in anything else in which I'd previously discovered that pleasure. And that's what happened to Haman. Yet all this availeth me nothing, so long as I see Mordecai the Jew. So long as or every time I see. Each time Haman is confronted with the sight of Mordecai, he's reminded that he is not held in universal honor. But part of Haman's great pleasure and illusion is that he is held in universal honor and that he deserves it. Now that was for a man who is seeking honor for honor's sake an unpardonable and deeply disturbing thing. Haman's pride had stretched his own sense of self-worth to great degrees, and Mordecai's disregard was a prick, constantly deflating his ego and challenging his perception. We see then that Haman's demand for honor is not grounded in reality, because Mordecai's challenge made all of his other avenues of honor seem worthless to him. Now, parenthetically here, we might ask, was Mordecai sinning by refusing to yield Haman this honor? And after all, Peter says, honor all men, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the king, 1 Peter 2:17. Paul says in Romans 13:7, render therefore to all their dues, tribute to whom tribute is due, custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. And we should remember that these commandments are rooted in the fifth commandment, honor thy father and thy mother. So, I'm not saying that honor is an illegitimate thing. Nor am I saying that we're exempted from rendering honor in clearly defined relations. Those who refuse to honor where honor is due are not only in rebellion to their earthly superiors, they are clearly in rebellion to God Himself, who established that order. Furthermore, if this rebellion continues without remedy, without submission, if the rebels don't reconcile with their superiors before they or their superiors die, the rebels have purchased to themselves a curse in this life, and in that which is to come, they purchased eternal damnation. So again, what of Mordecai? Well, I want you to consider, unlike parents who actually have to surrender their natural authority for it to become a nullity, or the ordinance of God, which must confirm conformity to the rule that God has established, Haman possesses neither a natural nor a moral ground for demanding this honor. In fact, even though we should assert that there was some lawfulness in his elevation by the king, we are left with the dilemma that this king, Ahasuerus, Xerxes, represents one of Daniel's four beasts precisely because it's a tyrannical imposition upon the sons of men. And should we add to this religious dimension, which I've mentioned before, and it's clearly recognized, I think, when Haman calls Mordecai the Jew, and we have a man possessed of great power without being clothed with the divine authority to exercise it. This complicates it. This is the power, then, which Mordecai rejected, a lawless power that was set against the moral ordinance of God and promoted the false religion of the Persian fire worshippers. In other words, Haman sought honor without having any natural, any moral, or really any lawful ground for receiving it. He demanded it without any right to do so. And his desire for honor was suspended solely, as we see here, upon his own sense of self-worth and nothing more. And thus, when Mordecai refused to pretend that there was something which rightfully demanded honor in Haman, he deflated the ego of a tyrant who had nearly universal power to destroy not only Mordecai, but his entire nation of the Jews. Yet all this availeth me nothing so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. The significance of Mordecai sitting at the king's gate is broad. It represents the continual petition for redress that is being made for justice from the throne of iniquity, which had been appointed for justice, but had been had been usurped to serve other purposes. It represents public dissent from the ungodly and false religions of the day. It represents a rejection of godless Persian culture and political tyranny. And it symbolizes the defiance of true faith. So impossibly for Haman, Mordecai spoiled all of his pretensions to honor and challenged Haman's perverse view of the world. Haman couldn't even so much as go in and out of the palace complex without the constant reminder being posed to him by Mordecai. And unlike many who don't understand the nature of the challenge, Haman grasped the fact that there was a contest going on between worldviews. There was a conflict of cosmologies. His was a blind faith that only hardly showed favor. Mordecai's was a guided faith, assured of the love and kindness of the deity who was in control. Haman's religious views blinded him to what was really going on and encouraged him to place his trust in a reed that will pierce through his hand when it breaks. So he turns, having presented this account, to hear what his wife and friends are going to say. Verse 14. Then said Zeresh's wife and all his friends unto him, let a gallows be made 50 cubits high, and tomorrow speak thou unto the king, that Mordecai may be hanged thereon. Then go thou in merrily with the king unto the banquet. And the thing pleased Haman, and he caused the gallows to be made. Then said Zeresh's wife and all his friends unto him. Zeresh begins to speak, having heard the case laid out by Haman. And we see in this that she's a woman both decisive in action and careless about the future, a trait that she shares with the first woman, Eve. She's first in this sin, to be sure, the one that she's about to propose, but Haman, like Adam, is going to own it for himself. Her impulsiveness is quickly adopted, in fact, by all of Haman's friends who are present at this gathering. What's going on is actually, in a small compass, a picture of the fall of mankind all over again. How did Haman get here? It was through the fall. He's become an enemy of God because he is a fallen man, and he's owning it for himself. She decides Haman should take advantage of his preferment before the king and strike quickly against Mordecai. That's her advice. She says, let a gallows be made of 50 cubits high. The height of the gallows, or the Hebrew really just says a tree, meaning a tree of wood. The height of the gallows was to be roughly 75 feet. Just under 23 meters. That's the size of a building over 7 stories tall. Just to put that in a little bit of comparison. Now, the purpose of this is described in a couple of clauses which follow. But at this height, it's going to be visible to most, if not all, of the inhabitants of Shushan, and perhaps visible within the palace complex itself, because it's going to stand higher than the walls of the fortress around the palace complex. By making such a tall gallows, Haman is going to be making a monument upon which to commemorate his victory over that troublesome Mordecai. That's what Zeresh is really trying to advise here. Let a gallows be made of 50 cubits high, and tomorrow speak thou unto the king. That is tomorrow in the morning. The Hebrew, again, speaks of the morning, boker. Speak thou to the king. Now, according to the rabbis, this was so that they would have a word with the king before the Jews could get about saying their morning prayers. They're superstitious. They want a word with the king before they're in any danger. that the king is going to, or that the Jews are going to be praying to God, and that there might be some divine intervention, or the fates might somehow intervene. Again, Zeresh sees the need to move swiftly while fortune seems to smile on Haman's undertaking. So she's eager to press for more favor from the king, since he's already been so inclined to yield power to Haman, and she really joins in Haman's assessment that he's on a good path with respect to royal power and prestige with these banquets. And tomorrow speak thou unto the king that Mordecai may be hanged thereon. So, we're told the purpose of the monument is actually to suspend the body of Mordecai upon it. Now, there's been a bit of discussion about whether or not Haman intended to impale Mordecai. We know from Herodotus' histories that was a preferred method of punishment by the Persians. The verb just simply says he was hanged, and so there's been some discussion as to whether or not this was by a noose from a gibbet, like we're somewhat familiar with that. We don't see it actually happening now, but we've seen pictures of it. We've seen depictions of that kind of hanging. Or is it just some other manner of suspension upon this wooden pole? Well, I think the first has the weight of historical considerations on its side. The last has the matter it has a merit of conforming to certain Jewish usages for malefactors. We know that they like to hang malefactors on trees and suspend them, dangling their dead bodies, and so on. The least likely is actually the manner probably most familiar to us. What is notable, as I said a couple minutes ago, is the very size of this wooden edifice. Seven and a half stories tall. Now, that would actually be sufficient if you understand that the average person is approximately 3 cubits, I believe. That would mean that the height of the average person, this would be sufficient, actually, as we'll see later, to take care of Haman and his 10 sons, with leaving room between them so that you can distinguish how many get hanged from this. Whether they're impaled or hanged, the text says they're going to be suspended on this. Now, the monument which Zeresh is probably intended was a warning designed to turn Mordecai's execution into a national event. If Mordecai's at the top of this post, hanging, everybody's going to know it. But in reality, it's going to be used to make the destruction of the enemies of God a national spectacle. Now, another question has been raised. Why did Zeresh counsel using a gallows or a tree of wood? The rabbis speculate that she knew something of the history of Israel, and she knew that they had escaped a lot of other kinds of destruction. So, you know, if we were to dump them in the water, she knew that at the Red Sea they'd escape drowning. If you threw Mordecai to the dogs, well, she knew the dogs didn't bark when Israel left Egypt. If you threw Mordecai into the fire, well, she knew the story about the Hebrew children. They weren't burned by that fire. Threw them to the lions. She knew Daniel escaped the mouth of the lions. If you put him in prison, he might actually become like Joseph, who rose to rule the kingdom, and so on. So having exhausted all the other possibilities, they say Zeresh resolves to hang Mordecai. Tomorrow speak thou unto the king that Mordecai may be hanged thereon. Then go thou in merrily with the king unto the banquet. After making that bloodthirsty suggestion, because it really is, whatever is going on, however they're going to hang them, whatever exactly is the process here, Zeresh moves to council that once having achieved the permission of the king, Haman should go quickly into the banquet with the king. Now, it's almost incredible if you think about the juxtaposition of these two ideas. Because ominously, she says, go merrily or rejoicingly. So we can see here, I think, the hatred the world bears toward the church and people of God. This is a religious contest, and she, like her husband, understands it. And at the thought of having vanquished the Jews, there should be reason enough to go rejoicing to the feast. It's not an uncommon thing in these ancient people, when they persecuted people of God, to go, as the Romans did, from watching Christians being ripped to shreds by wild animals to a banquet. Or even banqueting while the Christians were being ripped to shreds or tortured. Go thou in merrily with the king unto the banquet. And then we're told, finally, the thing pleased Haman. He's immediately pleased with the advice of his wife. Her counsels not only carried the approval of his friends, but it now, we're told, has carried his approval. It pleased him. That in contrast, by the way, to Mordecai, beholding Mordecai, which has clearly displeased him. Right, so, beholding Mordecai, not reverencing him, displeasure. The thought of impaling or hanging, suspending Mordecai on a post for everyone to see his dead body, pleasure. Thing pleased Haman, and he caused the gallows to be made. So eager was Haman to follow through with this advice, he didn't wait to take advantage of the help that he could have commanded to build the gallows. Right? He just waited a little bit. Remember, he had all that power over all these other people, servants of the king. He could have employed them. Instead, the inference here is he spent the night building a 50-cubit high gallows upon which to hang Mordecai. And that, again, his pride and arrogance is on full display. None could possibly dissuade this guy of this plot. He wished to be fully prepared then to execute that plot as soon as he could speak with the king in the morning. Now, the rabbis say of this that Haman was so eager to build the gallows that night that he dismantled part of his own house to find timbers big enough to erect that gallows 50 cubits high. Now, while this may not have occurred literally, it is, in fact, what he actually did when he went to war with the true religion and placed himself as an enemy of the people of God. He was tearing down his own house. So, in conclusion, then, should you give the whole world to a man who seeks his happiness in this world, he will still find something lacking. Genuine pleasure and real contentment begin in ordering the soul aright. The things of this world cannot give right constitution to the soul while it is at enmity with God. Nothing can be substituted for that divine favor which God alone can bestow through Christ. A sensible apprehension of this is what Thomas Brooks, a Puritan author, called Heaven on Earth. Those who do not know God and His Son, Jesus Christ, though they possess 1,000 worlds, they will not, they cannot know the way of peace. They might have many things, but unlike Mary, as she sat with Jesus, they will always lack the one thing needful. It's only in Christ that the Apostle Paul tells us he learned to be content with whatsoever things he had. Mordecai is a man at peace under sentence of death. Think about that. Haman is a man greatly vexed, though he has virtually everything this life can afford. Let us then side with Mordecai and seek peace, even that peace which passeth understanding, in Christ. Amen.